I'm Steve Boyd from Walking the Walking Dead, a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. You can check out other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com. And get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Proactionary. Proactionary? Is that a word?
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 118 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we wake up from one of the weirdest dreams ever to realize that it's Christmas morning and we've been given a brand new season of Torchwood back in Cardiff. Then we wake up from one of the weirdest dreams ever to realize it's Christmas morning and we've all received actual working TARDIS. Then we wake up from one of the weirdest dreams ever to realize, you get the point, it's a long story.
Long story.
I am Jay, and with me in the GPR studios this week is Keir. How's it going, Keir?
Very good, sir. How was your Christmas?
It was fantastic. I got like all kinds of Doctor Who stuff. It's absolutely amazing. But and then over in the corner trying to find batteries for every last gadget that we got is Haley. How are you doing, Haley?
I'm all right. I've got all sorts of charging cables now, so I think we're good.
Sounds awesome.
So this holiday week, you know, now that we've taken the time to clean up all the scraps of wrapping paper laying all over, we have absolutely jammed the cupboards with more leftover cookies than we care to admit, and have snuggled in with the family on the couch, wearing our new TARDIS footy pajamas and various Doctor Who themed blankets and such to watch what has probably been the best episode of Inception ever to air on television.
Yeah, that's the truth.
Of course, we may still be sleeping, so who knows?
Just ask yourself, do you believe in Santa Claus?
Iliup.
All right, well, before we get into that, we did actually get some feedback from a few listeners about our list last week, or our discussion last week about the Christmas specials that came before, and Soleil had some things to say about our choice, or the way that we ranked certain episodes here. So, sounds like he's recording from a bathroom, so just ignore that. He's in a pavilion, and there weren't a lot of people that show up, so you get some echo there.
Probably standing in the middle of Grand Central Station at the time.
Probably so. It sounds about right. All right, let's hear it.
Dear GPR Nation, Soleil here to present a succinct counterpoint to the Doctor, the Widow, and the Wardrobe. I just don't understand the negativity. You guys even went as far as to tell me directly, no, don't bother. Completely skippable. The episode is bright, cheery, and fun, with Matt Smith playing to his two greatest strengths, acting with kids and being utterly crazy madcap. Clockwork tree, lemonade tap, brilliant. It even had hammocks. The treeple were pretty beautifully designed too, and Madge saves the day and her hubby. I'm starting to think you guys are dead inside. Perhaps it was because you set my expectations so low, but it really wasn't that bad. As I look across all the Christmas specials, this one falls squarely into my top three. No spinny chainsaw trees, no weird spiders, or tin Santas. This is one of the good ones, people. Take a breath. Nah, the backwards helmet bit was pretty dumb, though. I'll give you that.
I do have to say that. Absolutely valid. Yeah, and I have to say that I never wanted to take away anyone's enjoyment from this episode. I was just voicing my personal opinion about it. So if you were able to watch it and enjoy it, fantastic. Better. I mean, I didn't ever want to tell anyone that they're wrong for enjoying it.
I always felt, you know, it's not a terrible episode. If it had happened in the middle of the season, it'd be one of those mid-season episodes that was kind of forgettable.
Mm-hmm.
But because it stands alone around Christmas time, that's why it kind of falls short of what your expectations are.
Yeah, and as I said last week, this is the first episode that I was actually able to watch live with everyone else around the planet, and it was just, like, you know, there was a level of hype there for me in my own mind, so it just definitely did not live up.
And then when you put it against, you know, just seeing what Smith was able to do with some of the other Christmas specials that he was handed, you know, between, or even including the snowmen in there, you know, those are, we hold Christmas Carol in such high esteem because it was such a, you know, such a tight episode and tight script and great story and well executed. So yeah, setting the bar at that level is kind of hard to attain. But you know, if that's the kind of, you know, as he says, that madcap kind of zaniness and that complete break from any of the tension that normally surrounds, some of the other episodes of weight. And that's what you enjoy every once in a while, because that's your sort of a break from the intensity. Hey, fantastic. You know, I'm glad people enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I think our listener Richard agreed with him too, because he said, that he's looking forward to hearing what we thought about the Doctor Who Christmas special and to hear me complain about it.
Yeah. So we'll cue you up for your complaints in a couple of minutes.
Yeah. So let's actually go ahead and jump into the episode now. So what did you guys think about it? Haley?
I felt like it went on like one or two dream sequences too long.
Too many layers on the onion?
Possibly.
Well, you weren't
I'm not
alone.
Even sure if we're awake yet.
Yeah. I mean, I love the premise. I love the idea of, and the execution of being able to handle how disjointed and disconnected and warped dreams can be, especially when you realize that you're in one. You know, those odd moments. And I think Moffat did an excellent job of being able to kind of convey that through some of the discussion, mm-hmm. saying how, you know, oh, there's jumps in time, there's jumps in location, but your brain tries to correct it all and make it all seem all right by distracting you and keeping you off focus. Which felt very valid, you know, or the fact that dreams are slowly lost upon waking if you don't really try to focus upon them. I mean, that was all a really interesting capture. I enjoyed the whole story. I mean, this was definitely, as far as prepping us and saying you are going to get a genuinely kind of creepy Christmas episode, I think we got that.
Yeah. And
especially, you know, going back and looking compared to all the ones we were discussing recently, this genuinely had a lot of the creep factor that some of the others really have not carried in a long, long time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Rum Daddy wrote in and he agreed with you. He said, you know, that the Alien / Inception would have had a bigger punch had it ended 5 or 10 minutes earlier. Huge build up to a mediocre payoff. And I think that's what it is too, is the fact that it was just, there didn't seem to be much of a resolution until the very end. And even then it was just kind of like, oh, okay, well, everybody woke up. Yay.
Well, knowing what we know now about the fact that the script had to go back for a major edit, mm-hmm. might explain that kind of clunky, you know, bow tied on the end there, or that weird moment with older Clara that resolved itself, you know, because they were preparing an original script to write her out.
Yeah.
So maybe that's as a result of a sort of a hasty patchwork.
Possibly so. I mean, at this point, that's all still rumor. They haven't actually come out and said that she was supposed to leave. And it looks like they definitely left the spot there where it was like, okay, if she wants to stay, then we can go this way. If she wants to go, then we go that way. And you can tell where the breaking point is there. So I think that there is a lot of validity to that, but again, it hasn't been officially confirmed. So.
Right. But I think all in all, and I was totally aware of this through the episode on the first watch. You know, this, you know, normally the first watch, I'm just sort of looking at the glitz and being, you know, wowed by the spectacle. And then I start really taking it apart at a more meta level the second or third time through. But even right off the first viewing, I realized that this is, you know, as we've seen so much this year when Moffat was actually the hand at the pen or at the keyboard, so to speak, this was playing to his strengths. You know, this mm-hmm. is him using a genuinely kind of creepy element. You know, going as dark as he claimed he wanted to with a doctor who could carry that with strength, playing with words, you know, a lot of tight dialogue, a lot of banter, a lot of bickering, but throwing, you know, a really twisted plot there. He loves the timey-wiminess and does so well with it.
Mm-hmm.
But then all of the dialogue is laced with a lot of emotion and then spiking all the really creepy, some of the most genuinely terrifying moments, and he like just drives a humor spike right through it, you know,
yeah.
with the elves or whatever. There's just these moments, you know, that he loves to do to just sort of knock you off your wheels a little bit.
Oh yeah, I mean, so that's something that I've heard Joss Whedon talk about before too. He's like, if people are laughing too much, you scare them. If they're too scared, you make them laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And, I mean, it works very, very well. So
let's dissect that a little bit. What were some of the aspects? We'll take the creepiness. You know, the fact that this was supposed to be kind of a dark, a more alarming or disturbing Christmas episode. How did that work for you?
I mean,
it definitely creeped me out.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those moments where I woke up this morning and was kind of like, "All right, I'm actually awake, right? Am I awake? I'm awake."
We could do a little inventory. Hand your wife a book. Turn to page 57.
Yeah, it's one of the things that really come out of strong Moffat scripts where he's trying to scare you is the things that make you question reality. You know, you look at the weeping angels, the silence, listen, you know, all these things that you really can't quantify and no one can ever really disprove, like, you know, wholehearted, like 100% say that this can't actually be the way it is. And I mean, this is another one of those things where it's like, you're like, well, I could be dreaming and not know it. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, and he fully embraces that,
mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that the whole dream state is so slightly off center and allows him complete freedom in his writing. You know, things can be as unusual as possible or just as, you know, as implausible. But you write it off because, well, they could be in a dream state. So, you know, mm-hmm. Well, sure. All right. I'll let it go. Santa Claus. Okay. Fine. You know, I mean, face huggers.
I have to say, going back and watching this a second time, you get a lot more out of it, and things that may have bothered you the first time around really, really don't. Like, I mean, they're good. Like, Shona really started to bother me the first time through. I'm like, how did this girl ever get on a scientific expedition?
I was thinking the same thing.
And I mean, it was one of those things that was really, really bothering me. And then I went back and I watched it a second time. And as soon as she starts dancing, you understand, okay, this is a girl that works in a shop that's in a dream. This is hilarious. And I'm just rolling at that point because I understand what it is.
Mm-hmm. See, I kind of thought the first time through, maybe they picked her for that part of the mission because, you know, she's like got the memory of a goldfish. So she's like perfectly suited for this part of the mission.
I thought you were going to say that she was the red shirt, but
yeah. Well, that's exactly what I was thinking
that
too.
Who's gonna Did you guys it? Think face huggers as soon as you saw those things?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And then that was what was such a great payoff when the professor there says they're kind of like face huggers.
Yeah.
And then an even better payoff when you see her Christmas movie list.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but those are the little details that I think that just leave me picturing Moffat, you know, sitting in his office behind the keyboard giggling to himself about how clever he is for putting this stuff in.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. But I love the doctor's reaction to the whole face huggers thing. There's a horror movie called Alien that's really offensive. No wonder people keep invading you.
It's a Christmas tradition now.
Yeah.
But speaking of Christmas traditions, and everyone was saying, oh, we finally got away from the tin Santas, tin robots. The tin robots were there. They just weren't Santas or aliens or angels this year. They were little wind up robots that came in. So they were technically represented.
Yeah. And I mean, the whole entrance with Santa there was like, it was one of those epic moments where you're like, wow, that's just Santa's badass.
Yeah.
Until you see the car alarm on Rudolph, and then you're kind of like, wait, what?
Yeah. But you let it go, because at that point, it's so over the top that it's suddenly acceptable. And Nick Frost carried it with so much, so much comfort, you know.
And there were times where, like, you're really like, wow, this is completely Nick Frost. And then a second later, you're like, holy crap, that's Santa Claus.
I think, as far as the creepiness factor, as far as going with the, you know, the dream crabs and the face hugger, that sort of thing. I was impressed, sort of surprised that they were as graphic in their descriptions about how they were affecting their victims and that sort of thing. The liquefaction of the brains and the boring through the skull, that sort of thing. I'm like, well, okay.
The straw.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of like you eating that turkey leg.
He was eating it so noisily.
Well, that was one of the things where, as I'm watching that, and especially in the second viewing, I'm thinking to myself, you know, some people, if they're in a dream where their brain is trying to calm them down, you know, they're in a horrible situation or something. Okay, his comfort is he goes to food.
Yeah.
All right, I get it. But yeah, he was just demolishing that thing mid conversation.
Yeah. Although I was sitting there when he starts getting sucked into the TV and stuff, I'm sitting there thinking, you know, shouldn't the second doctor's son know better than to approach monsters like this? Cause that's just, for anyone that was unaware, that was actually Michael Troughton. That was Patrick Troughton's son playing the professor. So
who does an eerie impersonation of his dad, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, now on the flip side of that, so we've got the creepiness factor in there, well conveyed, and yet, hey, anytime you can do your monster just with a fancy glove on your prop crew.
Yes.
Have them wiggle their fingers at you. Nicely done. But there's the humor side of it as well, which was just rampant in this one. If you take away the darkness of some of the aspects of this episode, this thing was freaking hilarious.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you've got, you know, Nick Frost, who's a hilarious actor to begin with. You've got Dan Starkey, and you strip away all the potato jokes. You know, mm-hmm. And then you've got Capaldi delivering his, you know, flat-out dry wit. It was brilliant.
The verbal sparring between he and Santa was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic when they're just kind of cutting into one another for being, you know, who they are.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved it. And then the elves in the background going, ooh, ooh.
Oh, that was cool with the box. Not often we get upstaged on a rooftop.
Yeah. Well, you know, how does he fit all the presents into his bag? Bigger than the side. Ooh. You know, it's just great stuff. I mean, this is Moffat's sitcom writing.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah, and when he's got that nailed down, it works brilliantly when he's got the right premise and everything like that. You know, like having him holding a balloon animal as a gun and threatening with it.
Well, he did have a toy gun, but it was unsafe for children under four.
Exactly. Small parts can be choked on. It was great.
Now, the one of the things that I was noting on this was that they, in giving Clara her... There were a couple of things that were handed back to our characters. You know, some of the questions and some of the concerns that we were left with at the end of Death in Heaven, needed some progression. And we got that. We weren't really sure how much they were going to deal with that right now versus how much they were going to kick the can down the road to the start of Series 9. But as a result of the discussions they had in their shared dream, without actually physically spending any time together or having any conversation together, we've been given a bit of resolution between the Doctor and Clara. And we've been given a little bit of a resolution or a little bit of a calming of the waters as far as fan concerns over Clara and Danny. But I'm just going to hand that but over to you.
I thought that it was great actually seeing them, you know, admit to each other that they lied. You know, it's like, well, I did this so that you'd do that. I lied to you. I'm sorry. Well, I did this so that you'd do that. I lied to you too. And I was like, holy crap, we have growth.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's just like 1 minute of dialogue and everything is solved.
Yeah.
Well, it just showed that they both really wanted to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. I don't think that, I think that might have been something where the moment that scene in the tea shop was over and mm-hmm. they both realized that they had withheld something for what they thought was the right reasons, that probably sat on them pretty uncomfortably.
Yeah.
Because they were very quick, to just put that right back out there again when they were in a situation where it really mattered.
Well, and that kind of is telling with what the Doctor says at the end, when he says, you know, the crab probably got on him and found Clara in his subconscious and the rest of the people were collateral damage. I'm like, with all of the people that he has met across his life and they come across Clara first, that means that she was foremost in his mind when it mm-hmm. happened.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that kind of tells you right there that she stayed on his mind.
Mm-hmm. Or the fact that I noticed that though he realized the dream crabs were such an unknown, you know, even to him, you know, he had heard of them and never seen them, and that they were, you know, essentially it was a near death sentence for anyone who had fallen victim to one. The moment Clara had fallen to them, he's just, we've got to kill it. We've got to figure out a way to get it off.
And yeah.
When he's explicitly told and the Doctor having to be told something, there's no way to kill it that we know of. His next solution is, all right, I'm gonna put myself at risk. Drop me in. So yeah. It's just more and more of a realization or his coming around to the fact that he is not as willing, not necessarily capable, but not as willing to go it alone.
Yeah. And I think that we always complained about the fact that Matt Smith and Jenna Coleman seem to be like, okay, these are two actors on a screen together that are exchanging lines. And there was never really any chemistry between the two of them. You know, they were fine together, but there was nothing saying, okay, this is why she would sacrifice herself for him. And I don't know if it was orchestrated this way or just the fact that these two have such a great on-screen chemistry, but you really do feel the connection between them. And you understand, okay, yes, the Doctor really does care for her in this way, and she loves the Doctor because he is this person to her. And it is just such a great building of that relationship to the point that I can understand why she would be heartbroken over choosing to leave him behind, or, you know, choosing to stay behind, and why he would have such a hard time moving on without her when there were stuff left unsaid.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's again, I kept picking up on the gift of the Magi parallel, you know, and it's, to me, that I'm glad that it allowed them to be able to rectify these things between the two of them, so that for those people who, I don't know, for whatever reason, didn't end up watching this episode as sort of the 13th episode of the season, and they just pick up again with the top of series 9, mm-hmm. there will still be a little bit of choppy water that needs to get smoothed out between them once they start actually traveling together again in earnest or in reality. As far as, you know, if they trace their totem back and they're pretty sure they're back out of the dream. But the one thing that I'm still kind of wondering over, because it just seemed like Moffat doing his move, was giving us one last goodbye to Danny.
Yeah. So Danny's dead, but not really.
But here he is.
Right. So talking to Dream Danny, who's a little bit taller.
Fraction of an inch taller.
And that idea of, and I love the sentiment. I love the fact that, and this is all Clara's subconscious telling her to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, Danny would want me to move on. Danny would want me to be able to function and grow and travel and adventure, whether the Doctor's in there or not. You know, and we get this little glimpse of what Clara's life would be if the Doctor didn't return for 60 some odd years. You know, which is interesting in and of itself. You know, she travels the continent. She learns to fly. I mean, she has that adventurous spirit, whether the Doctor's at her side or not.
And she never actually marries.
Right.
Right. Although, lots of proposals.
And I mean, but that's funny when you think about the fact that this is in her subconscious. It's like, so she's expecting plenty of people to want her, but she's still at that point where she's grieving and doesn't think that there's anyone that she'll be able to match Danny.
Yeah. Right. But, well, here's the interesting thing. What about the sentence about the, there was one, but he was impossible? Is that a tip of the hat to Smith?
I think it's a tip of the hat to the Doctor in general.
I don't know.
Well, this was Julie's comment as we were talking about this the other night. She was saying, you know, well, Clara was Eleven's impossible girl.
Mm-hmm.
Very specific about that. So
yeah, I did get that parallel to it. But I think that it was more just it wasn't so much a romantic thing as it was, you know, just there was one person who could match Danny. There's one person that I had as much affection for as Danny, but it was impossible to be able to be with him.
Mm. Yeah, I got the same sense as you did, Jay.
So, I mean, it can be taken either way. That's the great thing, is they did leave it vague enough, but I did get the whole impossible reference, but I don't know if it didn't tie it specifically to Eleven for me.
Okay. Right.
But I did love the part where Danny, or where the Doctor keeps on saying, you know, he died saving the planet, and Danny's final response to that is, no, I died saving Clara. The rest of you were just lucky.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, if there was any sentence to describe how badass Danny was, that was it right there.
And that's the way Clara sees him, because that's mm-hmm. who's you know, reflection of him that we're actually seeing and hearing from. So,
but the thing is that is true to his character too, because had that actually been Danny's ghost or something, I would have expected the same line.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't this idealized version of him. It was, she remembered him exactly as he was.
Right.
Just, you know, I kind of expected when she was talking to Danny for her, like, Christmas gift or her one last thing she had to tell him to be, you know, the reveal that she was pregnant. Up until the end of that scene, I was expecting that information to come out in this episode.
Mm. Yeah, but now that she's staying on for next series, I don't think she can't be. Yeah. I mean, unless they're going to be, you know, have that be a thread that's going through, is, you know, her trying to hide her pregnancy from the Doctor, a la Amy Pond, but, you know.
Right, I was going to say, we did that one already.
Yeah.
But no, if that information were going to come out, it would have been specifically in the scene where she's saying goodbye to Danny again.
Yeah, I agree. So I don't think that's actually going to play out now.
Right. And I also kind of noticed that at this point, if they wanted to, they do not, the Doctor seemed so, easy to just spill. I never found Gallifrey. I just threw it out there, which means that tells me that it's not necessarily going to be a predominant theme, or does not have to be a predominant theme in series 9, because it's something he might have just come to terms with for a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I don't think that it's something that they have to go to now. You know, had he been like, you know, I've been trying and I just can't find it and I don't know what to do, then yes, it's going to be something that's going to recur. But because he threw it out there, no, I went, it wasn't there. Now let's get back to the conversation we're having. It definitely downplayed the importance.
Right. Well, see, what else did we want to pull from this specifically? I know we had gotten, you know, some feedback that actually went along with one of the points that I was kind of focused on, which was how they were handling the presence of Santa throughout this, you know, and the fact that we, you know, didn't really know how we were going to deal with. Again, we dealt with the same thing with Robin Hood, you know, big finger quotes here, fictional characters being involved in the who construct here.
Yeah.
But I think Bobby Honeycutt kind of, you know, he wanted to tip the hat to Moffat for not necessarily outright calling Santa the fairy tale. They kept playing with that statement.
Yeah.
Throughout.
Yeah.
But then they also just kept saying, you know, well, this is your dream. This is you trying to hold on to aspects that make you feel safe. Or that can be an anchor for you.
Mm-hmm.
We got to call
Ghostbusters.
It's North. It's all, you're on the North Pole. It's Christmas. Yeah, of course you're gonna think. But I do love the exchange between him and Shona when she said, "You're a dream that's trying to save us," and Santa says, "I'm Santa Claus. I think you just defined me."
Yeah.
I mean, it is great. They did have fun playing with the persona of Santa Claus and all of the different, you know, it's like, well, I can't hit 22 million children in an hour. I've got a second slide. That's
yeah. That he did that same sort of delivery a couple times. The magic carrots line was the other way. He's got the coffee mug. Oh yeah. Well, I've got two slides. Sip a coffee.
Exactly.
That's why I feed a magic carrot. Sip a coffee.
Yeah.
It's just that easy kind of, you know, quick gag that Nick Frost does so well. He did the same thing. You go back and you watch Shaun of the Dead and see the moments where he hits a punchline and takes a sip of his pint. That's a trademark Nick Frost move.
Yeah, it
well,
really
I
is.
Think just based on the evidence we've seen, there's actually got to be three sleighs because, you know, he had three reindeer with him. There's 9 reindeer total. So I think he's got 3 teams.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but apparently the chimneys are impossible to miss, which, you know, the elf proved. I mean, some of the dialogue that you hear, just like it's real subtle as Clara's coming out, just golden. It was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. And you'll get that. That's one of the things that I probably watched this. I don't know about you guys. I probably watched this about 4 times now. And every time I do, I'm either on a different format. I'm just either watching it living room TV or I'd have it on in headphones on a tablet or something. And I'm catching some of the secondary dialogue that's going on. It's a little lower in the mix. And a lot of it was between the two elves, Ian and Wolf. Mm-hmm. As they're going back and forth, and that was just phenomenal stuff. I mean,
oh, yeah.
that's where I think a lot of the roundness of the episode really resides, in the fact that there was so much attention to little details like that. But the dance maneuvers, you know, in the middle of the infirmary. I mean, she was fully committed to that dance. I mean, she's getting as she was approaching that back door and she's like down on her knees. I'm like, this is going to become a pole dance. She's getting a little creepy.
When she was like playing her leg.
Yeah, that was brilliant.
Right before that scene started, I was trying to remember what the song was, and I just kept seeing like the Guardians of the Galaxy scene at the beginning. I was waiting for Come and Get Your Love to start playing.
Yeah, the thing, the first time I was watching it is they were really building up the tension at that point. So she starts dancing around and the rest of them are like, are you kidding me? This is what you, and I'm fully committed at this point. I think that this is serious and intense. And I'm like, she's going to bump one of the beds and then all hell's going to break loose. And that's what, and I kept on thinking like, oh God, this is going to be bad. But going back and watching it the second time, I really did enjoy that whole thing. I mean, she was fantastic throughout it.
So I'm guessing you all are going to have Merry Christmas by Slade on there as the new addition to your Christmas mix for 2000.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's required at this point. Although, did anyone else, when they said we've got your playlist all queued up and everything like that, did you expect Last Christmas by Wham to start playing?
Yes.
I was waiting for it. And as soon as they started playing anything else, I was like, oh, thank God.
It would have been a much different dance move.
Very much so, yeah.
So
I was waiting for Jingle Bell Rock, and then we'd get the scene from Home Alone dancing around the living room.
Right. Well, all in all, though, I mean, I think a lot of the feedback that we received echoed the sentiments that we were picking up on, both the positive and the negative. And there were some kind of negative ones. You know, the ending did seem a little bit like a, you know, a couple of pump fakes as we, you know, like avoiding the bends. We would come up layer by layer by layer, so it just wasn't too much to handle. But could they have consolidated a bit?
Yeah.
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 Yeah, I think they could have dropped a couple layers from the onion and it would have been a little better.
Mm. Although the last segment, though, or the segment with older Clara, I was about to say old Amy. Use a pattern much? Was some necessary discussion, and I think it goes along with the leaps and bounds that her character has developed, that we now get to see what her pocket universe life would have been had she not traveled with the Doctor for that time.
Yeah.
The life of adventure, the learning languages, the visiting countries, the proposals turned down.
Well, and the thing that really stood out to me was the fact that, like, you know, she said, you know, there was nobody else or whatever. And you got to think at this point, she's still hung up on Danny. And in her mind, yes, people are going to approach her. She's going to have relationships in the future, but no one's ever going to match up to Danny. So it makes sense that in her mind, you know, living out her entire life, she would say, oh, well, you know, there's all this stuff that happened, but, you know, I never found anyone else.
Mm-hmm. Well, Danny, or the Doctor, for that matter. Not necessarily as a romantic relationship, but just as far as putting somebody on a pedestal and using them as a basis for comparison, it's kind of hard to match up.
Yeah, just slightly, just a little bit.
Yeah.
But
and, you know, seeing what she...
ziplining through the Amazon doesn't quite stack up against, you know, facing down a sun god.
Right.
With a leaf.
Well, and seeing how she sees what her life would be like in the future, even if she's not with the Doctor, she's planning on having adventures and traveling and stuff. What would her life with Danny have been like? Because that's not what he saw in his future. You know, he was ready to be a homebody and stay put for the rest of his life.
That's why they never would have worked out. I'm sorry. Quit shipping this stuff. It's not going to happen. You know, one of the things that really did stand out to me, though, was at the end when they're doing the Christmas cracker and the Doctor, like, puts his hand on hers to help her pull it. And I mean, it was almost a shot for shot remake of what we saw Clara doing for the old Doctor in Time of the Doctor, whatever it was. Mm. The last of the Doctor trilogy. Yeah, but that was, to me, that felt like this was a natural breaking point. This was a perfect way to wrap up the Clara story and say, look, it has come full circle now. And then, oh, wait, one more Santa again, and boom, we're back.
Well, it would have been a nice little button on the end of the whole thing if it really were the end of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Which just leads me to wonder how much of that might have been the theoretical original script.
Yeah, exactly. Because it did feel like it had that, you know, like, okay, we're writing up to this point, and once we get a decision, we can go this way or we can go that way. And it felt like it at that point, the script kind of stopped and said, okay, who's got the map? I need to know which way I'm turning here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Turn left.
Nice pull.
Well, you know, we had, you know, feedback from folks like, you know, one of our friends there, Rum Daddy, had said that, you know, he was digging the whole Alien / Inception feel to it. Would have felt that the ending had more impact had it been, you know, one of the original endpoints, you know, the one we got 5-10 minutes prior. And just let the rest of it kind of sit either as something to carry over into the next season or maybe just left to the viewer's imagination, you know, let you finish the story internally.
No, see, that's the thing. Series 9 is all going to be a dream sequence because you saw the little tangerine at the end. So the Series 9 is all going to be one big dream sequence. Then we wake up and realize that Claire has been dead for 30 years.
I can't see how this could possibly go poorly at all.
I mean, come on. No matter what they choose to do, they're going to piss off some portion of the fans. So, you know, go big or go home.
Like a brilliant plan.
Although you do notice that that a lot of times when they're involving dream sequences and such, and there's an alien planet involved, it's some sort of a craggy outcropping with gaseous clouds coming up over lava and whatnot. So that's where the Doctor and Clara had their throwing the keys dream debate. But at the same time, the doctor woke up with a dream crab on his face on one of those little rocky outcroppings. He was just pretty much just avoid that planet.
Right.
That
See, I was wondering if he went back to get the key.
For a split second, yeah. I kind of stitched those two episodes together and thought, what is it about this freaking planet of lava that's got to be so important they keep going back?
They keep trying to dig out Anakin.
No, the one ring.
The one ring there.
You know how much stuff is at the bottom of that lake of fire? There's TARDIS keys. There's a freaking hand. There's a really kick-ass ring. Wow. I didn't realize that was such a trope.
How many other fandoms can we throw in here?
Chime in feedback at gallifreypublicradio.com. Let us know what other obscure sci-fi references involve throwing something into a volcano.
Oh, Joe versus a volcano? That was...
Nah.
But yeah, and then Trish also wrote in and said that said I loved it, chuckled a lot, also literally leaned forward, edge of the couch anticipation a few times. Really great.
Yeah, it did capture a lot of that alien cold editing feel to it. You know, the slow drips from the mouths and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Have we ever gotten such a great scream out of Clara before as we did when she was trapped under the table?
No, I mean, that was pure horror at that point. I wonder how they got her to react that way, because that was intense.
Yeah.
Although, did anyone draw the parallel when she's sitting under the table, like trying to distract herself and don't look at it, don't pay attention to it, anything like that? You kind of went back to listen.
I didn't, kind of. But I see where you're going.
I'm not saying that it was meant to be the same thing, but it was like, for some reason, when she was sitting under there, like, you know, night skirt and all that stuff, and she's, you know, trying not to look at it, trying not to pay attention to it and everything, I'm just kind of like, didn't we see this earlier in the...
It seems like a lot of the new villains that Moffat has created have kind of this similar thing of being involved with your memory somehow. Like, you don't remember seeing them, or, you know, in this case, they work on whether you... know that they're there or not, if you're thinking about them.
Pay attention to them, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's something that Moffat tends to do with a lot of the monsters he creates. I mean, there's always a don't that goes along with it, you know? Don't blink, don't breathe, don't look, don't think. It's like, you're not allowed to do anything around aliens. That's it.
Don't bother. Stay home. Don't travel.
Yeah, but...
home is where the good internet is. Oh, wait.
Yeah, Haley gets to reconnect with family because her internet's not hooked up. It's the true meaning of Christmas.
It's going to be ready by Christmas, guys. It's cool. Oh, wait.
I came over to spend the holidays with you so that I can ignore you and go talk to other people online. Great to see you too. I'll be upstairs.
And then the last little bit of feedback that we got was Raymani said, not sure I like this one. It should have ended sooner than it did, with Clara heading off with Santa. In fact, my mom watched it, well, was in the room, and she thought it had ended at that point. So, more to the point of just it got a little long in the tooth.
Mm-hmm. Kind of a Return of the King problem.
Yeah. It's like, and we're now halfway through the ending of 18. And
Well, you realize at that point you got to run all the way back across the countryside. I mean, you've had your adventure. And now
we just spent three movies walking across this country, and you expect us to get back in 10 minutes? No, not going to happen.
Go find Sylvester McCoy. I'm pretty sure he's got a jet.
It's powered by rabbits.
Rabbits.
Well, now we're looking at a big, fat, long hiatus. What shall we do to fill our time?
Lists. All lists.
Yes.
21 reasons why we should go back and watch the whole season over again. 12 reasons why tangerines really aren't so bad.
18 things that prove that David Tennant is the best human on the planet. So next week we are going to actually be taking a look at Capaldi and his predecessors, the ways that he kind of what's the best way of saying it, just kind of combines everybody.
The culmination of the doctors that have come before, knowing that he's such a long-standing fan of the show. You know, he talks about a lot, oftentimes in interviews, about how he likes to chat with the cast and crew about classic episodes and things like that. So to this day, it's still at the forefront of his fondest memories. So there's got to be some aspects of those tributes that have worked their way into the persona that he's created for the 12th Doctor. We're going to look and see, you know, the ways that it has worked into his representation of the character, possibly in his demeanor or even at times in his dress code, so, you know, and his interaction with his companions.
Or, you know, as Keir so eloquently put it here in the show notes, the melting pot of Rassilon?
Yes, it could very well be the melting pot of Rassilon, or the fondue pot of Rassilon, if you prefer cheese.
I feel like, I don't know if I was supposed to ask a question with that, but there was a question. I pulled a whole Ron Burgundy thing.
Bees?
I'm Ron Burgundy? but we've got a little bit of news this week. The big news, obviously, being the fact that Jenna Coleman's going to come back for Series 9. Yay! It's
for you know, 5 minutes.
No, actually,
she comes back. They kill her in the first 5 minutes. Oh,
I looked at the article that we've got a link here to, and there's nothing in there, but the BBC actually did confirm, and Moffat and Coleman as well during a press interview, that she will be back for the entirety of Series 9.
Okay,
so at least one more series with Jenna Coleman, which I'm excited about this. I know there are people that are still lukewarm about her, if not completely like hating on her, but I'm excited. I think that she was a great companion. Once she got on screen with Capaldi and they really found their rhythm and their chemistry, I think she's great. So I'd love to genuinely
hear from folks that are still on the He-Man Clara hating club. I'd honestly like to know. Please, shoot us a note, or you can even get in touch with me personally, either on Twitter or through the through our GPR email accounts and such, or feedback on the episode, because I'd like to know if she hasn't at least given you an entertaining series this past 13 episodes. Where is she missing the mark? You know, what has she not been able to accomplish for you as a viewer that you were hoping to receive from her? Or if it's just something about her persona that rubs you so much the wrong way that you'd rather anyone else be there. I'd honestly like to know the reason behind it. Not because I feel like getting into some sort of flame war or anything. I genuinely want to know.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd that would be great to hear. Yeah. And then the next news article that we've got here is apparently according to the British Film Institute, keep in mind the BFI, the British Film Institute here, the Doctor is the number one sci-fi character of all time. And I mean, this tops the list of 100, and you know, he's followed closely by Ellen Ripley, Darth Vader, then fourth place is, Cara Avon from Blake 7. So if you didn't know you were in a British list yet, let's just,
okay.
Well, then you've got Captain Mel Reynolds from Firefly. I don't even know.
Jakar
from Babylon 5. Okay. Mm-hmm. HAL 9000, Rick Deckard from Blade Runner, Han Solo at number 9, and Spock at number 10. So
okay, so top 10. I'm following all of these. I can get that. Then the list gets squidgy.
Yeah, a little bit. Then you got Captain Jack Harkness at number 13. Then Yanto Jones at 19.
Stop.
Stop. No, get this. So Yanto Jones is a better sci-fi character than Starbuck from the revitalized Battlestar Galactica at 22.
Stop.
I can't.
Sci-fi characters of all time.
He narrowly beat out Yoda. I mean, this was, yeah.
Oh, hey, Crichton from Red Dwarf is down here towards the bottom at 88.
No, but I mean, this.
Yanto beat out the Master. The Master is number 90.
Well, the Master never played naked hide and seek with Captain Jack, so you know.
Well, there is that. That.
But I mean, this is a very interesting list, and if you go through it, I mean, there's names on here that I was like, you know what, that does make a lot of sense. I didn't think about that, but you know, you've got E.T., the Terminator, Professor Quartermass from Quartermass in the Pit. Just a lot of different, across a lot of different genres, or not genres, but a lot of different mediums and things like that. So
and facets of sci-fi, you know, yeah. You get some of the hardcore sci-fi versus the stuff that's more approachable, or you could say more mainstream. This is the BFI, but I'm seeing a lot of television crossed over with actual cinematic film. But so much of this sounds like it happened to be a bit of popularity contest ballot stuffing.
That's very possible. But, you know, it is very interesting to go and look and see, okay, for this time, for this slice of our time, you know, what is popular? What is going on right now? Like, what is it that people remember nowadays? Because obviously, if you go back 10 years ago, this list would be completely different. Things, you know, different things were popular. Different things would have been in the top 10. You know, the Doctor wouldn't even have made the top half of the list, you know, if at all. So
Kit from Knight Rider.
56, Lilo Dallas multipass.
Multipass.
But I mean, it is an interesting list to go and look at to, you know, to see just basically what it is in the mind of the culture today. Mm. And then the next bit of news that we've got is the Radio Times did a vote and found out that the Christmas Invasion was the number one Christmas special, according to fans.
Okay. I guess to a certain degree, that's probably because, you know, we're dealing with Tenet's premiere and looking back retrospectively and the massive appeal that he had in terms of popular viewership and continues to this day, then, you know, you associate it, you love the episode because of his introduction almost equally with the fact that it happens to be one of the Christmas episodes. So
yeah,
I get that.
Well, and the Christmas Invasion was like the first Christmas special. You know, this was an event, really. But right. Then the second place is The End of Time Part 1.
Mm.
So you get Tenet's entrance.
Hello,
and
doctor.
Then Tenet's exit.
Goodbye, doctor. Yeah.
So yeah, it's interesting. Christmas Carol coming in at third place. So, and then down at the very bottom of the list, we've got The Doctor, the Widow, and the Wardrobe. So ha!
The Snowman barely beating out The Doctor, the Widow, and the Wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to mention that part.
It's really when it comes down to it, and this is actually something that I had a quick Twitter discussion with one of our listeners, Radiant Baby, about this, because they chimed in saying, you know, guess I'm weird, I hate Christmas Invasion, because they felt that Rose had been whining the entire time.
Which she had.
And happened to adore Dr. Widow in the Wardrobe. So that's, you know, that may be the case. You know, it's valid opinions on both sides of it. It's really just a matter of the type of storytelling that you personally kind of gravitate towards. If you yeah. like the idea of the episodes that are more oriented towards the Christmas fairy tale kind of aspect, and less the, you know, Christmas comes crashing into the sci-fi world with blowy uppies and tin robots, then that's your personal take.
I mean, and that's the thing is, do you prefer your Christmas episodes to be Christmas episodes, or do you prefer them like, well, like this one, like Last Christmas, which was a Peter Capaldi episode first that happened to be the one that they showed on Christmas. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's be honest, you could have taken this episode and really smashed it in anywhere in the series. It really was episode 13 of series 8.
Except for the whole Santa bit.
Well, you know what I mean, though. They wrote a script for Peter Capaldi first, and right. then they put the Christmas stuffing in around it. So this is one that I really liked because that's how I like my show. And whereas Dr. Widow and Wardrobe had nothing to do with anything else. It was just, you know, hey, look, it's Christmas kind of thing. Not so much for me, but other people really like that. So it is really just a matter of what kind of story you're looking for in a Christmas special.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we've got this video that just, this is terrifying on all different levels. They've got a bunch of robots performing the Doctor Who theme.
Eek. Yeah. This made the rounds over the course of the past week and a half or so. I know I queued it up while on Christmas Eve while I was finishing up a half a day at work and let it sort of play in the background as I was doing other things. And after about 30 seconds, I had to flip back to it and just exactly see what it was that was producing what I was hearing. Which just made it even creepier.
Yeah, it doesn't help. The visuals do not help.
No.
I mean, the creepy robot playing the theremin just slightly off, and it, oh, no.
Mm-hmm. And it runs the gamut. I mean, this is as a result of this is one of the British universities' robotics clubs or departments that basically put together, you know, a whole gamut of different robotic representations, from mechanical arms to fully bipedal, you know, hominid looking creatures to things that just basically look like a speak and spell with a couple of, you know, D-cell batteries duct taped to it. But each one had its little function in contributing, along with a very creeped out looking sextet playing in the orchestra pit, wondering who the hell they're accompanying.
Right. Just trying to keep their eyes on all of them at the same time, make sure none of them sneak up.
That one keeps pointing that red blinky thing at me.
I swear to God, if one of them starts singing Daisy Bell, I'm walking.
And the kids in the audience,
oh, yeah. Did,
just the looks on their faces, they didn't know whether they should be amazed or terrified or both.
Yeah. I think they all landed on both.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't want to move and upset any of these, my future robot overlords.
One foot always turned towards the exit door.
Except for one kid who was super excited about it. He's definitely switching to the robot side when the the takeover happens.
He's going to be the one to flip the switch and sell us all out. Yeah. Then the next news article that we've got is apparently for being a Time Lord and having some amazing technology, Peter Capaldi really doesn't like it too much.
No, he's going to be the first one to tell you that that smartphones and PDAs and things that go machines that go bing are something that are as he's already convinced his family will just lead to tears and disappointment. So, and I don't think you really want to upset the man on Christmas or any other day.
Keep those eyebrows in upright and locked position.
Which means they probably had to like Hulk-proof the TARDIS console so that as he's just mashing buttons and slamming levers around and such, not really knowing or really caring a whole lot about what it was that he's maneuvering.
Yeah, that's it. The deleted scenes for Deep Breath are just the doctor. Why is it still blinking 12? Then the last little bit of non-news that we've got here is, apparently the Cybermen have realized that if we upgrade humans, that doesn't work out too well. Why don't we try squirrels?
Yeah, they're already emotionless creatures.
Yeah, so apparently there's a type of squirrel feeder here that looks like a Cyberman head, and it's hung at just the right height that when the squirrels try and get it, it produces a slightly terrifying picture.
Yes, right. Yes. I remember first seeing there's a novelty shop out of the Seattle area called Archie McPhee that started selling horse head squirrel feeders for the longest time. And you just basically you jam them full of peanut butter and then stuff, crushed nuts or birdseed or something up into the peanut butter so that it gums up on the inside of the head. And they'll crawl up and stick their whole face up into the thing for a while as they're working this stuff loose and packing their mouths full. So it gives you plenty of opportunity to run around the yard with a camera and take creepy, creepy ass photos of these things. So someone said, hey, natural progression, I'm gonna turn them into cyber rodents.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause that's a thing you can do.
Because when I wake up in the morning and I'm still waiting on my first cup of coffee to finish pouring, this is what I want to see staring at me through my window.
Ooh, I'll one-up you. Put an ood head out there. A red glowy-eyed ood head.
I actually saw a picture, and I wish I knew where I had seen it, because it was hilarious that someone had built a two-story snowman right outside somebody's window, and they had put an ood head on it. So you open up the window and you're on the second floor and you've got an ood staring at you. It was, somebody got beat.
Shall I prepare your clothes for the day?
No! That couldn't possibly end badly.
Yes.
But that's all the news that we've got this week. So, and that's actually, this is going to be the last episode of the year, which, ends in a couple days, so what does it matter? It's not like we're going without, but
welcome to the end of time, kids.
But so this has been episode 118 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, oh no, line in the sand, Santa Claus does not do the scientific explanation.
And this is Gear saying, oh, as the doctor might say, ah, oh, it's all a bit dreamy weamy.
And this is Haley saying, we are just three passing perfectly ordinary roof people doing some emergency roof things.
We'll see you guys next year.
Bye.
Have fun.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio. Or on Facebook at facebook.com/Gallifrey Public Radio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You can also go to GunnaGeek.com to check out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.